This Alternative Views program was recorded before Ross Perot dropped out of the presidential race.
And then there's the grandmother of all scandals, which is the October surprise, what's called the October surprise. If it can be shown that the Reagan-Bush campaign did in fact negotiate with Iranian interests to hold the American hostages until after the election so that Carter would lose, and in return that arms shipments were made through Israel and other conduits to the Iranians as a payoff for holding the hostages, then you have an act that meets all the classical legal tests of treason. It means that the 1980 election was stolen. My favorite scenario is we find out it's true and we impeach Bush, and we then proceed to undo the damage. Every appointment by the Reagan and Bush team to the Supreme Court, to the federal judiciary, to the whole executive branch of government is out. They're all illegitimate. And we can clean out this infection that got in there in 1980. Ross Perot knows about George Bush. He knows why the POW MIAs weren't being taken out of Laos. He knows Richard Armitage was there as the bag man for the opium money coming out of Laos, going to the Nugenhan Bank in Australia, and that Richard Armitage was the one in charge of the POW MIA issue, and that's why nothing was happening, because they didn't want to expose the drug dealing that was going on.
And this is part of Reagan and Bush administration policy. Bush was the drug czar.
You got to remember, Clinton himself is vulnerable. Mena, Arkansas.
Yeah.
Was a major transshipment point for modification of planes for drug smuggling and weapon smuggling, and was a huge part of the Iran-Contra operation, Barry Seal operation.
The Contra supply operation.
The Contra resupply operation.
We had a story on it.
And people trying to fight that in that county, the district attorney of Polk County, went to Clinton and said, give me a budget so I can prosecute these people. And Clinton did not respond.
Well, there was a guy in Clinton's office who was actively involved in supplying the Contras.
That's right.
We look into the momentous scandals of the Reagan-Bush years and see how they fit into the 92 election. Right now, on Alternative Views. Although this program was recorded before Ross Perot dropped out of the presidential race, the information and analysis in the program are very important to consider.
Well, folks, it's that time again. It's the 1992 election coming up, and this time it's really weird. It's so far foiling all the forecasts of the pundits. George Bush had it all locked up. Remember, the Gulf War, he had 90% approval rating, the highest in history. Well, he was barely able to beat Pat Buchanan in some of the early primaries, and now all of the polls show that Ross Perot is whopping him, even though Perot hasn't even officially said that he's going to run in the election. Well, we're going to explore the 1992 election today in a different perspective with Lanny Sinkin. Lanny was involved for many years with the Christic Institute in Washington, D.C., and was researching the scandals of the Bush administration, the Iran-Contra scandal, the October surprise, Bush and Noriega, and a whole variety of other scandals. So Lanny has been a Bush watcher for some time, and we want to discuss with him what's really at stake for George Bush in the election. Why is Bush doing so poorly? What does the Perot candidacy mean? What is going on in this 1992 election? So, Lanny, thanks for coming back.
Well, it's my pleasure.
Well, to begin, why is Bush in trouble?
Bush is in trouble for a lot of different reasons. First of all, certainly the economy. and the decline of the economy, the acceleration in unemployment, the acceleration in corporations leaving the country, and I think more generally a perception that, a correct perception, that the Reagan-Bush era was a time when economic policies were designed to concentrate wealth into a tiny percent of the people at the top and impoverish vast numbers and wipe out the middle class. And it became so obvious that they were doing this that a book could be written. Bartlett and Steele wrote What Went Wrong, America, What Went Wrong, $6.95, a paperback. Anybody in the country could go pick up a book and read how Reagan and Bush did it to the country. The sense that all the economic policies did was provide play toys for the rich, and that they didn't use the economic incentives to create jobs or research and development or improve the environment or anything except to do takeovers and get-rich-quick schemes that wiped out many long-standing, well-respected corporations in this country and left behind the wreckage of an economy that we'll barely be able to recover from in the next 10 years. But that's one element of what has alienated people, and it's a very profound one. They're looking at the Bush leadership and thinking this is not what they wanted. I think a second element is that related to the economic policies were scandals. The savings and loan is one of those bridge points where you see not only an economic policy of deregulation or no regulation, but that policy then results in an incredible ripoff of hundreds of millions of dollars or billions of dollars from the taxpayer to go to people who played fast and loose with these banks, and that was encouraged. The head of the Task Force on Financial Deregulation in the Reagan era was Vice President Bush. He happened to be head of financial deregulation, drugs, and terrorism, all of which we think he was very successful in. That a lot of people understand that the policies followed by Reagan and Bush did create this wreckage in the economy, turned us from the greatest creditor nation into the greatest debtor nation, did all of those things, with environmental consequences as well. The scandals that emerge are also beginning to look rather profound. It's not just your garden variety political corruption. When you look at something like the savings and loans, $1 trillion probably it's going to cost the taxpayer. It's sort of off the scale.
It's an expensive party.
A real expensive party, and the hangover is really a killer of a hangover.
But we got the hangover. The party people are doing fine.
They salted it away. Then you look at the scandal that's now emerging in good part thanks to Congressman Henry B. Gonzalez of San Antonio, of how the Bush administration armed and financed Iraq. And someday it will all come out about how Bush manipulated Saddam Hussein into invading Kuwait and that the whole war was a setup from the beginning.
Well, we did that on our program.
I'm sure you must have. For those who've been awake for the last 20 years in this country, you watch for that kind of thing to happen.
It's come out that Bush is the point man for Saddam Hussein ever since around 1984, 1985. It was Bush who would call the import-export bank and tell them to loan money to Iraq. It was Bush who would fight against sanctions against Iraq. It was Bush, and this was while he was with the Reagan administration, was pushing for a tilt towards Iraq in the Iran-Iraq war, giving them military intelligence, giving them aid that could be used for military weapons. And Bush continued this up until a few days before the invasion of Kuwait. Bush was giving all kinds of agricultural credits to Iraq. He was giving them all kinds of loans that they could use for military equipment. This is really a scandal.
Well, the agricultural credits were being ripped off to buy military equipment, and the Justice Department knew about it and did not prosecute for a year while it continued, and altered documents that were sent to Congress about the situation, documents that went through the hands of Robert Gates when he was National Security Advisor. So we don't know whether he altered them or not yet, but we're seeing familiar patterns here of phony information coming out of certain people that have a long history of doing this. That scandal, the commercial commodity credits scandal, is one of, the three big ones. The second one, I think, is Gander, which people still don't know much about.
I don't know much.
Gander?
The Gander crash in Newfoundland killed 256 U.S. military people. That we now know, thanks to the investigative efforts of Gene Wheaton and others, was in fact an Oliver North leased airway that it was illegally carrying weapons, that it was probably bombed out of the air by the Islamic Jihad because there was a super secret team on board that was trying to get the hostages out, that the whole thing was a major disaster caused by the Iran-Contra operation that was immediately covered up by the FBI and by the forces of the United States government, to the point that the Canadian Safety Board, which reached a conclusion that it was ice on the wings that caused the plane to go down, immediately dissolved after reaching that conclusion because almost half the members disagreed and said it was a bomb, that whole story is starting to come out. And if that does actually surface in a major way, people will understand that the Iran-Contra scandal was quite clear to the top levels of the administration in 1985, and that this business of finding out, you know, later is total nonsense.
And that Bush was right in the center of it.
And Bush was right in the center of it. And then there's the grandmother of all scandals, which is the October surprise, what's called the October surprise. If it can be shown that the Reagan-Bush campaign did in fact negotiate with Iranian interests to hold the American hostages until after the election so that Carter would lose, and in return that arms shipments were made through Israel and other conduits to the Iranians as a payoff for holding the hostages, then you have an act that meets all the classical legal tests of treason. It means that the 1980 election was stolen. My favorite scenario is we find out it's true and we impeach Bush, and we then proceed to undo the damage. Every appointment by the Reagan and Bush team to the Supreme Court, to the federal judiciary, to the whole executive branch of government is out. They're all illegitimate. And we can clean out this infection that got in there in 1980 and start over again. Well, it's a fantasy. We can all have our fantasy.
Great fantasy. However, that's been effort all week.
You said, if it is true, from the tons of things I read about it, it's certainly true.
My own personal opinion is it's true.
I mean, there are so many people, so many researchers, the book about it.
Gary Sick's book is so well documented.
Gary Sick's book is excellent. But you're going to have to watch carefully is the problem. The FBI recently discovered a box of tapes, the wiretaps of Hashimi, that they hadn't had before for some reason.
Iranian arms dealer,
key player, playing with Carter, playing with Reagan, playing both sides. And apparently one of the tapes even has a conversation between Reagan and Hashimi, according to Reuters. One, it's the FBI. Okay, that's the secret police for the Imperial National Guard. Well, let's take a look at where it's coming from. And two, these are tapes they just discovered in a box somewhere. What is really going to come out here? There's going to be so much disinformation and misdirection thrown at that October surprise.
Already has been tons of it.
You know, Newsweek came out right before Gary Sick's book. So did New Republic. Tried to trash his book.
Go ahead.
Well, all I'm really saying, though, is I hope we prove the October surprise and get the results that I'd like to see. But all of these things are each having their own corrosive effect.
What about Bush's support in the October surprise? Do you believe that he was actually present at that October 1980 meeting in Paris?
No,
you don't.
I do believe that when William Casey flew back from Madrid, the earlier meetings in Madrid, in the summer, he did in fact meet the next day at the Alibi Club with George Bush and debrief on what those meetings in Madrid were all about. I believe Bush was wired in from the beginning. Well, whether he was in Paris or not, again, we're getting these folks come, Russbacher and
so you're having
Brenneke,
these pilots and these arms dealers who are very unreliable saying
Israeli,
they saw Bush.
The Israeli
intelligence is also claiming that Bush was present in this Paris meeting.
Yes.
And then these people are totally discredited. So that discredits the story as if Bush was innocent and being framed
Set
up.
That's part of the way they do it.
That's the way they cover.
They get somebody to come forward and claim they can prove it, and then when they can't prove it, everybody says, well, then it must not be true, when in fact it was true, and this person was never intended to prove it.
Right.
I think it should be stressed that this October surprise was just part of an overall scheme of penetrating the Carter administration by the Reagan team. and the stealing, you know, the little thing,
the stealing of
the book for the debates was just part of it. The Reagan, it was like the Reagan folks were the United States and the Carter was a third world country. They had people at the highest levels with top secret and better clearances. They had admirals and generals forwarding, stealing top secret
running
documents.
Running a covert operation against the Carter campaign.
Even stealing documents from the security advisor, Brzezinski.
Right.
And it was incredible. And yet, all this, the press won't touch it.
Well,
and
they
the Democrats
it for a
won't
while.
Touch.
It was
just
played out a little bit after six op-ed piece in the New York Times.
Yes.
All of the talk shows, Nightline and Donahue and Crossfire, had programs on this. And the major media had at least stories on it. Then it disappeared again.
Well, it's now in the hands of Congress and the investigation.
Yeah.
And it's not clear. The chief investigator, Larry Barcella, has a mixed career. But he knows who some of the key players is. He did the Ed Wilson prosecution that put the ex-CIA agent in jail for 52 years for dealing with Libya and all that.
But he's small change compared to something that's going to really rip apart the whole system.
Well, I understand. And that's why I'm concerned as to whether that will be pushed to its logical conclusion. The only real point I'm driving is that with all of these scandals and many more, BCCI, the Bank of Commerce and Credit International, that seems to have involved all kinds of dirt and money flowing into our political system and all of that. That one's coming along. There's a long list of scandalous activities. And one of the things it's done, and by the way, is push attention over onto George Bush's family and their activities. You know, one son with the offshore lease for oil from Bahrain, another son involved with the Contras and the Silverado savings and loan, on and on and on,
his
everywhere you look.
Involved with Yakuza. Or Yakuza,
the Japanese gangsters in Japan.
Deals.
This is raising other concerns, all of which, to me, says George Bush has been weakened in not only the general constituency of the country, where his support was never that strong, but even in his core groups, in the Republican Party, there are people who are withdrawing from him. And then Ross Perot shows up.
Okay.
But isn't there some, it depends on how you're looking at it. It's true, we can say that Bush is in trouble, that he only has the so-called 42% or 47% approval rating, and that he usually only gets, unless something else happens, maybe 47, 42% compared to Pat Buchanan's, you know, so much.
Right.
And a lot of other people are uncommitted. But this means that no matter how rotten Bush is, he's got 42 or 47% of the people backing him. So he only needs, you know, 5% more, and
but
he's
that's
in,
erodious.
51%.
I mean, this is what's so interesting about the Perot candidacy. It's really seriously eroding Bush's majority or his possibility of winning. I think Bush figured that Clinton was pretty weak, pretty fragile
that's
himself. Damaged goods is the words I was looking for.
He
himself was involved in so many scandals that his scandals would outplay Bush's scandals. And therefore, Bush would just sort of sneak in against a weak Democratic candidate. But now Ross Perot comes in, who claims at least he's Mr. Clean.
Right.
I mean, every day the New York Times has an investigative article on his business activities or his political past, but they haven't really gotten anything to.
They haven't really landed too many punches.
Too many heavy punches.
Perot is a threat to Bush, I see, in three ways.
Okay.
First, for those who do participate in the political process, and that is a small percentage of the potential electorate.
Right.
But those who have participated and have supported Bush, Perot offers a real alternative. I mean, here's a person now running that says a lot of the kind of things that they relate to, and that they can, with good conscience, turn away from Bush and go to someone. They don't have to go to the Democratic Party at being Rock Rib Republicans. But Perot is like, okay. I mean, Reagan's campaign manager just went to work for Perot. So that's one way he hurts George.
Well, the Carter, a biggie in the Carter administration
Jordan.
Went to work.
Hamilton Jordan
went to work.
And Perot's getting as many supporters from Clinton and the Democrats as he is from Bush and the Republicans.
That's right.
And that can add up to a victory.
It could. That's one scenario. The second way he hurts George, he brings into the political process a lot of non-participants, people who had basically dropped out. he's the one bringing them in. It's like what Jesse Jackson did 4 years ago. Jesse Jackson brought in a lot of people, so they were loyal like crazy to him. And it didn't matter what anybody said about Jesse. He was their man. Well, I think the people Perot brings in who are actually out there registering to vote because he's running or getting his petition signed or holding his rallies, they're in because he's there. And it won't matter what the New York Times says about Ross Perot.
The more the media bash him, the more excited about it they get.
That's Ross Perot even said that. He was asked that question about, you know, what's... here comes the third way he hurts George. He was asked on David Frost, what about all these stories surfacing about you being a tyrant and all this stuff? And he said, well, you know, those stories, if you go back and read the press on me before I said on Larry King, if everybody wants me, I'll run, you don't find any of that. These stories are coming from the Republican Dirty Tricks team, he called them. And he used the phrase like three or four times.
Well, totally accurate.
Accurate description. And one of the things he said was they tried that on me down in Texas.
Right.
And when they were finished, I was ahead of George Bush in the polls.
Right.
Okay, so it didn't work very well.
Right.
But the little flag he's waving there, Ross Perot knows about George Bush. He knows why the POW MIAs weren't being taken out of Laos. He knows Richard Armitage was there as the bag man for the opium money coming out of Laos, going to the Nguyen Bank in Australia, and that Richard Armitage was the one in charge of the POW MIA issue, and that's why nothing was happening, because they didn't want to expose the drug dealing that was going on.
And this is part of Reagan and Bush administration policy. Bush was the drug czar at that time.
This goes back even before.
Let's go into the background of this, about how the U.S. government was involved in drug running in Southeast Asia and how this relates to the MIA POW issue.
The Southeast Asian connection was it's something we have seen over and over now in covert operations. Covert operations use people that can fly planes and land them in difficult places. They need to get past borders. They need to ship weapons. The drug pilots are one great recruiting ground for the covert operators. And there's a trade-off. You fly our guns, we let you fly your drugs. And this relationship has existed over time. It really, the first major exposure it got, I think, in this country was by Ramparts Magazine during the Vietnam War.
Right.
But it's not new.
And a guy named McCoy wrote a book called
Alfred
The Politics
McCoy.
Of Heroin in Southeast Asia.
Yes.
It was published in 1972 and republished.
Just recently
with
republished.
With some new information that goes all the way through Iran-Contra.
You can go back to the Chinese Revolution, the Kuomintang, where their chief of intelligence, Tai Li, was the head of the Green Gang, the largest opium smuggling gang in Asia, and sitting in Burma, at the time, if I've got this right, you've got General Singlob, now general, but then a different rank, whatever it was. You had Singlob there as both a CIA agent and a military man working with Tai Li. You have all of these historical connections that go back between the drug trade, organized crime, covert operations, and they all just seem to be epitomized by George Bush. That this is the culmination of the national security state operation finally seizing the presidency in the United States, and that understanding is beginning to seep out a little into the country. It's not something still that's mainstream, but the threat that Ross Perot represents is he knows. If Ross Perot stands up and says George Bush is responsible for the flood of cocaine during the Contra War because he allowed those pilots to bring it into this country, we could have said that at the Christic Institute 10,000 times, and no one would have heard us. Ross Perot says it once, and it goes through the political system.
Let's go into this MIA, POW, and Perot for a while. Perot was obviously very famous for going over to Southeast Asia and supporting efforts to find American POWs and MIAs from the Vietnam War. Now, what did he find out later about them?
Well, apparently what was going on, Richard Armitage was a very highly placed official who was put in charge of the POW-MIA issue out of Thailand. And he was connected to this whole organization that the Christic Institute went after, of Shackley and Kleins and Von Marbod, that whole group that were involved in the drug covert operation connection. And were using the tribes in that area of Southeast Asia that were growing opium as warriors, as assassins, and were using the proceeds from the narcotics trade to fund that operation. And some of those proceeds were going to the Nugenhan Bank in Australia, which eventually failed in a major scandal.
It was a CIA...
CIA laundry and all kinds of things.
And Perot found out about this.
Perot found out that through the Christic Institute.
Right.
That Armitage was connected with this whole operation. See, Perot was very frustrated that this Thai office didn't seem to be doing anything. He was getting all these reports. Bo Greitz was going in, and they were hassling Greitz, and he was going in and getting information about people who were POWs. But nothing was happening to get them out, and he couldn't figure out why. Then he saw the affidavit that Daniel Sheehan prepared for the Christic Institute that talked about Richard Armitage's role, and a light went on. And he then began cooperating with us, exchanging information with our investigators and his investigators. We connected him with other investigators who were working with us and providing us with information. And I think he got a real education in just how dirty this administration is.
Greitz or Perot?
Perot. Uh-huh. Perot got the education. Greitz got his own form of education.
Yeah. Greitz has become a sort of populist right-wing critic of this establishment,
yeah,
too.
He has, and there's a whole issue there
that's
one of discrimination, in the sense that Greitz has very valuable information about the connection between the opium lords in Southeast Asia and the Bush administration group. And Greitz has this political thing that he's done with the Populist Party, which has alienated a great many people.
Would Perot, though, really blow the whistle?
That's what they're
Bush
terrified of, though.
And all of these operations.
I don't know if he would. I don't know if he would. But you got to figure, you're the Republican strategist.
Right.
You want to knock Ross Perot down, but you know that Ross Perot is holding four aces.
If they attack Perot, I mean, he's the kind
of
guy that if you attack him, he does not take kindly to this.
No.
I saw someone attack him on his Gulf War stance, saying, Mr. Perot, we hear that you were against the Gulf War, so you weren't a patriot. So he just blasted the Gulf War. I mean, the most outspoken critique I've ever heard in the mainstream media. So if the Republicans really go after him to attack him and discredit him, he's going to get his dander up. And he's going to go after
him. Well, he has said on national television, George Bush manipulated Saddam Hussein into invading Kuwait.
Right.
That's why I say we could have said that on this show a dozen times, and we have. And we reach a certain part of the population that's hip to what's going on.
Right, right.
When Ross Perot says it, he's talking to Joe Sixpack, who goes, what do you say about George Bush? He manipulated Saddam, and now I don't understand what's going on anymore.
Right.
And I'm going to listen to Ross Perot and find out more.
Right.
Well, Ross Perot has more. If they want more.
Okay, what is the more? What is the relationship, once again, with the MIAs that are over there?
Well, the bottom line problem was they did not want to encourage a lot of searching for, discovery, and freedom of the MIAs and POWs, because in getting into all that, they were going to uncover
the drug
connections.
But now,
so that it was blocked.
Could it possibly be that some of these MIAs are actually agents, the CIA agents who were left behind and also involved in drugs themselves?
Well, there were.
Not MIAs at all. Maybe they're agents who have just disappeared and are part of this infrastructure.
Well, I think you've got all the possibilities there. There are some people who are missing in action who went native, if you will.
Right.
They stayed behind and probably have families, live in villages, and don't want to be found.
Mm.
That's one group. Another group, they would put people up in the mountains in Laos and other places who had been through hell in Vietnam, and they'd feed them drugs. They'd send the drugs in up to these mountain camps to the vets who were just blown away by what they'd been through in Vietnam, and basically just keep them there for a while and then slowly detox them and bring them back to the United States. But there are all kinds of groups over there. Some are prisoners of war, who are in prisoner of war camps, and there's lots of information. There was a very good book.
You think they do still have prisoner of war camps?
Kiss the Boys Goodbye.
Yeah.
Monica Jensen and the guy that wrote The Man Called Intrepid, Bill Stevenson.
Yeah.
It's an excellent book. They collected a lot of documentation and information that there are indeed American soldiers still alive over there as prisoners of war in camps. And this is what Ross Perot was hearing, too, from people he believed. That people like Bo Greitz and others who had gone in there and come back out with sightings and information and all that.
So this really pissed Perot off.
Really pissed him off.
And this really sort of steeled him that he wanted to do something about it.
I think this may have been part of what convinced him to run, to even say that on Larry King, to open up that possibility. was that he got a look at how unpatriotic this
how
Bush
corrupt
group is, corrupt and you know, anything goes, and destroying the nation. I mean, and he's genuinely upset about the deficit. I mean, he sees this as just a cancer that no one's willing to even begin to address. So every year it gets worse and worse and
worse. Which was also to support this military buildup. I mean, the Reagan administration doubled the national deficit to do their military.
Of course.
Buildup.
Of course.
But I'm still not certain of how far Perot would go in, one, telling the people these stories that we're talking about, and then, two, doing something about it. That is, making someone like Ramsey Clark their attorney general. And to go after these people.
That's right.
I mean, Bush is really running for his life, just like he was in 1988. Bush's connections with Noriega, his CIA background, his Iran-Contra background, and October surprise were all on the sort of margins of the 1988 election. It was all over the alternative press. It barely got into the mainstream press.
If
the Democrats would have played this card,
if
somehow the mainstream media would have brought it up, Bush would be in jail right now.
Well, and I think the sort of aura of invincibility that you talked about earlier, about Bush, you know, coming out of the Gulf War, no one wanted to run against him in the Democratic Party because he was so obviously going to win.
Right.
That's fading away. He's looking ineffectual. He's looking inept. He announces he's going to hold a nationally televised press conference. The three networks say we're too busy to cover it.
Oh,
this happened just today.
Yes.
The New York Times had this.
Actually, you're touching on what my most immediate concern is, which is that the national security apparatus knows everything we've just said.
Mm-hmm.
And knows how
and
people
more.
And more, and how the people are perceiving George Bush and what a threat Perot really represents. And to digress for a second, I think Perot can come in basically one of three or four scenarios. Perot can come in and win.
Right.
Perot can come in and take enough away from Bush and enough away from Clinton to make it a stalemate that forces it into the House of Representatives, and then all
Clinton
bets are
wins.
Off.
Yeah.
Well, Clinton may win.
That's also a real complex scene, because the House elects
complex.
A president, but the Senate elects a vice president, and if the House can't come to any agreement, well, then...
Then it falls to the Speaker of the House, and then to the Speaker of the Senate, and then to the Secretary of State.
You
could end
up
with Baker as president. If Foley doesn't want it and Byrd doesn't want it, you can end up with Howard Baker being president. I mean, it's just all kinds of wild scenarios.
Yeah.
And the third one, and the one that to me is most realistic at the moment, Perot comes in and basically breaks the bonds between a lot of Bush supporters and Bush. They have someone they can go to if they're Republicans, or they come in because of Perot, or they just get disgusted with George Bush over the scandals and the family and all that stuff. And at the same time, Perot cannot articulate policies to deal with the major environmental and urban and social problems we have.
Right.
And so people aren't comfortable with giving him their vote.
Right.
And Clinton wins, almost by default. Clinton wins. There's a massive turnover in the Congress. And so while Clinton may be a good old boy Democrat and have sort of liberal, moderate, wherever
social.
The center is these days, he's sort of a little to the left of it, but it's so far on the right it hardly matters. But you'll have a wild card Congress with so many people in there for the first time, coming in on a protest wave, willing to jam things down the president's throat, that you might end up with that kind of Clinton wild card Congress.
Right.
And that all of this is what the national security apparatus knows could be the scenario. So their concern is, how do we, between now, beginning of June, and November, make George Bush number one again? And what scenario can we develop? My friends I work with, who are retired military or criminal investigators, those kind of types, hardcore conservative people in this country, but people whom I consider friends who deal honestly with me, say they think it's going to be international.
So
it's going to be China or Korea.
Really? And
Korea.
Gaddafi or Saddam.
That doesn't work anymore. That's one of the problems George Bush has.
Mm.
You know, he's got this image of putting up the dictator. This is the dictator of the week, you know, you're supposed to be afraid of, and then takes it down. You know, Noriega, and then Saddam, and then Libya.
All good old buddies.
Doesn't work anymore. Well, one, his old buddiness is showing up. But two, last time he tried it with Libya, and the two people who were supposedly responsible for Pan Am 103, mainstream columnists, conservative columnists, were writing articles saying, what happened to Syria? I thought they were responsible for 103. Everybody said they were responsible. And is this just George trying to boost his poll points? Well, when it becomes that transparent that mainstream columnists, even of your own persuasion, are saying it's manipulation, it doesn't work on the American people as well anymore. So my inclination is it will not be a foreign policy crisis, that they will develop a domestic crisis that will launch George Bush, that it will revolve around environmental extremists, eco-terrorists, who will be people who have either been manipulated by them or are them to commit some act or series of acts that terrify the nation, requiring a police state response in a limited fashion that can be lifted off after 5 or 6 weeks.
Well, those LA riots, which were also Las Vegas riots,
and Atlanta riots,
and Detroit, and you know, all through the
country. That was practice.
Could actually materialize.
Well, but they
could be a hot summer.
They don't want to impose martial law in this country in a way that makes them look anti-democratic. They really don't. They don't want to suspend the Constitution. Oliver North had his plans, and the Federal Emergency Management Agency, I think some people over there are droolers. You know, they would love to drop martial law in this country and run the whole place. But I don't think that the wiser, cooler heads in the national security apparatus believe they can drop martial law in this country and not have a bloodbath erupt. A civil war.
See, there's also not just the national security apparatus running the country. There's the corporate elite who own the television networks, the newspapers, the corporations, and they don't necessarily want a police state.
No.
They just want to make money and do business. And if these guys get
running
in their room, their way, I mean, the New York Times and CBS and CNN could knock off Bush and the whole national security apparatus in 3 days.
If they reveal all the things that
everyone knows.
That's right.
So this is, again, the tightrope that Bush is walking. Let me try another scenario on you, which is Bush has a heart attack. Okay?
Yes.
A real one or a fake one, and he's retired, and Dan Quayle comes to the fore.
It's howdy duty time.
Woodward and one of his colleagues wrote a book to resurrect Dan Quayle as a serious candidate.
And it fell flat. Pancake. I think Dan Quayle and Murphy Brown was the paradigm.
Yeah.
When it was all over, somebody took a poll.
Right.
And more people said they would want Murphy Brown for president than they would want Dan Quayle for president. Well, it's not surprising.
Right. So that can't work. I mean, some people think that was Bush's life insurance.
Absolutely.
Against impeachment. To pick the perfect idiot.
I don't think Bush is willing to play that role. I mean, they may have to give him a heart attack if that's the role they want. I don't think he's willing.
This can be done. This has been done. Right.
But I don't think Bush is ready to play that role. He still thinks he can
pull it out.
The economy's recovering. You'll see all the signs.
Well, he pulled it out in 1988. I left for Europe, and he was 15 points behind in August of 1988. I came back a month later, and after his ad campaign and photo opportunity campaign, he was 15 points ahead and stayed ahead.
Well, I mean, he had to cock
it. But I'm not sure he can do it this time.
I really
think Bush is in unbelievably serious trouble, and the stakes are so big. It's not only Bush's survival, but the national security apparatus, corporate control of everything, that something's going to happen.
Well, that's my concern, because
need to be alert for this
Absolutely alert. Watch for it, and I'd say watch for it in late July. Watch for things to start to happen in late July, because the timetable has to fit in. Whatever they're going to do, they have to move in late July so they can do their thing in August, back off by September, and go into October with the country calm again, feeling they have prevented whatever this terrible thing was.
I foresee the possibility of false surprises, of things happening very quickly in September and even October.
Possibly.
That it's going to muddle until then.
They have so much working against them.
Could Perot be bought off? Or scared off.
I tend to think not. He had to have gone through it all before he ever said what he said on Larry King. He had to have been willing to
that he could easily be killed because these are vicious people.
And take the chance that they were going to whack him.
Right.
And what he probably did is what some of the other people in this field I know have done. He let them know that if he got whacked, some of their folks were going to get whacked.
The big heat. that if something happens to me,
we go to the mattresses.
And certain documents come out.
Or some of your people get whacked.
You know, we've been talking about Perot as possible president and spoiler and all that, but we haven't talked about what kind of a president he would be. I think he'd be pretty scary.
I have my concerns about him. I've done all I can as sort of just a citizen activist to try and reach Perot with issues. They had a rally up in Portland, and I called down there to see what was happening, and they said, we're having a rally, and we're going to have a video camera, and you can tape a message to Ross Perot. So I went down there with my UVB screening sunglasses and my cowboy hat and my long-sleeve shirt on an 80-degree day, and I stood in front of the camera and said, Ross, I don't think you really understand what we're facing up here in Oregon with a 20% depletion of the ozone layer. We wear these, and we wear this, and we wear long-sleeve shirts on 80-degree days, and that's what ultraviolet B is all about, and that's what ozone depletion is all about. And I don't think, from what I've heard so far, that you really have an understanding of the environmental issue. Because what he said so far on the environment is, if we expand the economy and get good-paying jobs and have money in people's pockets, we'll then have the money to fix the environment.
That's the total techno-fix.
The techno-fix, that's a total disconnect between the fact it's the very consumer society that you're talking about expanding and increasing,
right,
that's going to destroy the planet.
Exactly.
So I told him I thought you have it upside down.
Right.
So I videotaped that and sent it down to him. I don't know if he ever saw it. I've sent messages through other people to try and get to meet with him and talk to him. I'm reserving judgment as to what I think of him. I have heard things, though, that do distress me.
Right.
His civil liberties record doesn't seem to be.
It doesn't seem to be very good.
Populists go to the left and the right. There's left tendencies, there's right tendencies. And this was perfect, getting the Carter guy, Hamilton Jordan,
right,
and the Reagan guy, Ed Rollins, on the team. You got both the right and the left. I've even heard stories that Perot has asked both Jesse Jackson and Pat Buchanan to be his vice president.
Well, and Gene Kirkpatrick.
Well, now, be careful with these things. See, this is the kind of disinformation
rumors,
that's coming
right
up.
Yeah.
Gene Kirkpatrick was a story completely fabricated by those two thugs who were newspaper columnists.
Roland
Evans and Novak.
Not Roland and Martin.
Evans and Novak.
Right.
It was fabricated by them. And
right,
spread out there as if it was real. Perot was asked the question, well, I understand you're considering Gene Kirkpatrick, and he said, oh, am I? That's
right,
news to me, but I'll
right
put her on the list.
Right.
Well, I am concerned about his overall attitude, and I want to digress for a second.
Okay.
In the eighth grade in San Antonio, Texas, I had an American history civics teacher named Vernon Adams. And the first day of class, he went up to the board, and he drew a line on the board, and he said, when you talk about politics in the United States, people are usually going to talk about this line. And over here is the left, and over here's the right, and here's the center. I think a much better model for what this country was supposed to be about is this circle. And at this side of the circle are the Democrats, and at the other side of the circle are the authoritarians. And you can get from democracy to authoritarianism by going to the left or by going to the right. So judge your political leaders by how close they are to the top of the circle, as opposed to whether they're on the left.
Perot
or the right
is using ultra-democratic rhetoric. He said,
sometimes.
Populist, right-wing populists can.
Right. He's saying, I want to let the people decide the issue. I'm going to have these TV polls.
Right.
I'm going to go to the people and find out if they want higher taxes, if they want this, if they want that, and I'm going to represent the people.
Right.
And on the other hand, he has a law and order rhetoric.
He has his own traditional value system.
Mm-hmm.
And no problem with that. He can have any value system he wants, as far as I'm concerned, as long as he allows me to have my value system,
mm-hmm,
too. When I hear him say something, as he said in the Barbara Walters interview, I don't think I'd allow a gay or a lesbian in my cabinet because the controversy over their sexual preference,
mm-hmm,
would distract from dealing with the issues. I'm thinking, wait a minute now. For some people, a person of Afro-American descent would be controversial. For some people, a person of Jewish descent, or a woman, or whatever. I mean, if you're worried about controversy.
Well, he misspoke. I mean, that was just bad.
But it reflected something.
He doesn't care what people do in bed. And I can't hear Dan Quayle or George Bush or most of these people say, well, what people do in bed doesn't make any difference.
He's certainly refreshing compared to them and his friends.
See, that's the popular stuff, is contradictions. There's libertarian and authoritarian.
On the other hand, he wants to have a dragnet to search out any drug users and drug
He talked about martial law. He talked about martial law. Get guns and drugs off
the house-to-house search.
Which, I mean, there again, if you have a candidate who understands that a major component of the narcotics problem in this country is United States government policy and covert operations, who doesn't say it, this is what I'm watching for. If he knows it and won't say it and goes and plays this game of it's the fault of the people on the street corner who haven't got an economy other than the drug economy.
That's bad news.
That's
real bad faith.
That's bad faith, exactly. Yeah. It's being dishonest.
Well, now the Clinton people know it. Some people in New York from Clinton's outfit, they called me up and they said, can you give us some dirt on George Bush? And so I gave them a bunch of references and a bunch of information. They know about it.
Well, the Dukakis people last time knew about it. They had some arrogant twits
in charge of the campaign who thought they knew best and that the American people couldn't handle the information, so they didn't use it. Right. But the on the, you got to remember, Clinton himself is vulnerable. Mena, Arkansas, was a major transshipment point for modification of planes for drug smuggling and weapon smuggling. And was a huge part of the Iran-Contra operation, Barry Seal operation.
The Contra resupply operation.
We had a story on it.
And people trying to fight that in that county, the district attorney of Polk County went to Clinton and said, give me a budget so I can prosecute these people. And Clinton did not respond.
Well, there was a guy in Clinton's office who was actively involved in supplying the Contras.
That's right. And I mean, so, you know, in one sense, if they ever went after Clinton for that, he has a great response he could make that may or may not convince the people.
Right.
And that is, as governor of the state of Arkansas, what I found was a major drug smuggling operation run by the United States government as part of the Contra operation. Well, everybody seemed to know about it. What was I supposed to do? If I had gone public and exposed this operation, I would have been attacked for damaging national security and treason and whatever else. And who would have believed me that it was George Bush's team that was smuggling narcotics into this country? So he could handle it that way. But he has that little cloud hanging around. And there's BCCI money, BCCI connections with Clinton that is hanging around like another cloud. I mean, this is not one of my favorite elections.
Well,
you know?
This, oh, it is mine.
This could be one of the more interesting elections. And what will be interesting is to see how much of this comes out. Now, we have to say it didn't come out in 1988.
It did not.
We were carefully monitoring that election. We had all kinds of shows on all these scandals and issues that we're talking about, and they never got into the mainstream media. The Democrats didn't bring them up. The mainstream didn't bring them up. And it could be the same thing again this time, or the issues could come out. This three-way contest makes it a totally unpredictable ballgame.
Yeah, that's one
last
of the
time the Bush administration could or the Bush team could control the election.
Right.
And it was fairly easy to beat Dukakis. But this time they've got a three-person
a wild card,
and it's just very tricky.
Well, one of the discouraging things for me is it should be a four-way election. We should have a candidate, we should have our billionaire or our party or our candidate, whatever it is we need, that's articulating the need for a sustainable economy on the planet, the need to stop ozone depletion, the need to all of those issues that we care about, that these guys, I mean, Jerry Brown did try. I give him that. He really tried. I think he missed an opportunity when he finally broke through the media barricade and was on national television.
He then disappeared.
He talked about the flat tax, for God's sake.
Right.
Who cared about the flat tax?
But
he had
also
so many other things he could have talked about.
From the media.
Well, once New York happened, they shut him out.
He
had a little window.
Yeah. Well, we'll continue watching the 1992 election and see what comes out. Lanny, thank you so much for coming and giving us this delightful show.
We have time for some news stories from the Alternative Press.
There are three good books to read. We've talked about one, America, What Went Wrong. It was made by a couple of people who worked for the Philadelphia Inquirer and has come out very quickly
as a book, but it gives, with graphs and statistics, all the various information of what has gone wrong in the United States economy and political system, and what has happened to the poor and middle class as compared with the rich during the Reagan-Bush eras. Well, there is another one called Who Will Tell the People? The Betrayal of American Democracy by William Grider. You might have seen his book, Secrets of the Temple, about the Federal Reserve. He was reviewed in Business Week, generally a favorite review, except they did say a few snotty things about him. But they indicated that what Grider is saying, that American democracy is in much deeper trouble than even what Americans imagine right now. He says the government is in the grip of a global consortium of powerful interests and elites, while Washington eagerly accommodates the wishes of the influential leaders. Ordinary citizens find that their needs are just not even bothered with. As a matter of fact, it's worse. Environmental safety laws are gutted, standard of living falls, and poor people are getting stuck with for bills like the savings and loan bailout. And meanwhile, the elites just keep humming along, although they may be a little worried right now. Another book which you should see is The Overworked American by Juliet Shore. She shows that American people are working considerably more than they did even as recently as 20 years ago. And so leisure time has fallen, and the quality of the time of life has suffered. Shore looks at a variety of sources. This is a multinational review review of the book. It's a multinational monitor review of the book. It says that that people worked more than an individual worked more than 162 hours than they did in 1987. This means an equivalent of an extra month of labor per year. Men are working 166 hours more, and women are working 160 hours more. But by putting it in perspective, it's amazing. She says that we could now produce our 1948 standard of living, which is pretty darn good, I remember that, measured in terms of marketed goods and services. We could produce that standard of living in less than half the time that it took in 1948. We actually could have chosen the four-hour day, or we could work 6 months a year, or workers in the United States could now be taking every other year off with pay. This is because of technological advances, which allowed more production. But where people took this extra money was for consumerism, not for less work. What's happening in Europe? Well, workers in Europe are working, in Germany at least, they're working 8 less weeks of work a year than their U.S. counterparts. And the Swedes are working 11 less weeks. Why do the corporations do this? Well, naturally, money. They don't have to, if they have people doing forced overtime, they're paying them time and a half, but that means they don't have to hire new workers at full time. And it also means they don't have to pay new workers the benefits, fringe benefits, that take a lot of money out of the employer's pockets. Juliet Shore credits the labor movement with being responsible for the big decline in working hours from the Civil War to World War II. But after World War II, mainly after 48, they dropped this from their agenda, and we've been working harder and enjoying it less ever since.
In fact, it's stunning, the figures about the decline of the work week and the amount of vacations that they get in Europe in comparison with the U.S. And basically, this change has taken place in the last 15 years, and it's one of the results of the Reagan presidency that they totally destroyed the union movement, because as you indicated, it was the union movements in Europe that were able to reduce the hours of the work week. I might note that every idea that was in that book on the overworked American was previously written in Andre Gortz's two books, Farewell to the Working Class and Path to Paradise. For several years, I taught those books, and every single one of those ideas had been circulating in Europe for the last years. And basically, Gortz said that the capitalist system is going to collapse unless it shortens the work week, simply because technological unemployment is going to reduce the number of jobs to such a degree that unless they reduce the work week and share labor, there's just simply not going to be enough jobs for people. And Gortz maintained this whole detailed blueprint about how this would be possible. And that seems like the same ideas that were brought up.
But things are going the other direction. Families have to have two incomes in order to survive, not just to live well, but to survive. And single parents have to have two jobs in order to survive. So this is getting worse and worse, and there's going to come a time when the families just can't even with two incomes make it at all. But it's like that old thing about the Americans just blowing along, and oh well, my goodness, we're the best country in the whole world, I'm an American, by golly. And that reminds me of the thing about the frog. You put a frog in hot water and it'll hop out. But if you put a frog in cold water and gradually increase the heat, he'll stay in there and it'll burn up. It's like the Americans. I wonder how long they're going to take this line down.
And that's Alternative Views for this time. Frequently hear from viewers who request a list of news publications which we use on Alternative Views, and also a reading list for U.S. power structure in the mass media. If you would like to have these, send a stamped, self-addressed envelope to the Alternative Information Network, P.O. Box 7279, Austin, Texas 78713. You must send a self-addressed stamped envelope. We certainly enjoy getting your mail. There is an awful lot of it, and sometimes we get a backlog. So if your letter seems to have taken a long time to answer it, well, please be patient with us, because we will get around to answering it. We'd like to thank our crew for making our program possible today. Eric Eubank was our camera person, and Kevin L. West was our audio man. This again is our address if you would like to write to us. Alternative Information Network, P.O. Box 7279, Austin, Texas 78713. This has been our 470th program since we first started Alternative Views back in October of 1978, and it's been very enjoyable producing the programs and to getting your response to them. Please write to us. Goodbye.